Good morning. So last night I gave an overview of the four Brahmavihara qualities, the skillful states of kindness and compassion, appreciative joy and equanimity. And these are the natural resting place of our hearts and minds, and they're the natural expression of the development of our practice. When we've managed to release the visiting afflictive and painful states. And as I said last night, of these four qualities, it's the first one, metta, that tends to get the most attention. And so because this is a short retreat, and there just isn't time to go into all of these Brahmavihara in detail, this morning I'd like to spend a bit more time with compassion. Now, ideally, we would have a few days to build a base of metta practice first. But at least you got a small taste of it a couple of days ago in the afternoon. And there are plenty of guided metta meditations available on Dharma Seed and Insight Timer and various apps. So you can perhaps fill in that gap at home later. So just a little bit more context now before we move into some actual compassion practice. As I mentioned last night, karuna or compassion is the capacity to turn towards suffering and to meet it with metta or kindness and, where possible, to help it to release. So coming back to the relationship between metta and karuna, compassion, metta is the foundation that all of the Brahmaviharas arise from. And then when that base of friendliness, of goodwill, of kindness is developed, we can turn it towards what's difficult and painful in our own lives and in others' lives and meet it without resisting, without shutting down, without being overwhelmed by grief. And those movements of resisting and shutting down and grief are afflictive states that commonly do come up in relation to suffering. And in fact, the Buddha's teachings recognize that as we start to cultivate these skillful states, it's likely that at first we'll encounter quite a few obstacles. In fact, you could say the Brahmavihara practices are almost designed to show us what gets in the way. And it's for this reason that they're sometimes referred to euphemistically as purification practices, because they tend to reveal the obstacles, the conditioning, our conscious and unconscious strategies for staying shut down, like the sea anemone with its closed tentacles. But also, like the sea anemone, we're unable to nourish ourselves. So in the classical teachings, each of these Brahmaviharas have what are known as a near enemy and a far enemy. And these are common afflictive states that tend to come up when we start trying to cultivate the beautiful qualities. And at least for myself, I found it reassuring that these so-called enemies were known and named all the way back in the early teachings, and that I was not the only one who would sit down to try to cultivate kindness and at times find myself totally numb or shut down or seething with petty resentments or bored out of my brain or nauseated by the goodness of it all. Wow, sounds like some of you might recognize it. So those are some of the enemies, and the far enemy is the direct opposite of whatever quality we're trying to develop. So in relation to compassion, the far enemy is cruelty. So instead of the motivation to relieve suffering, it's the opposite. It's the sadistic wish to increase someone's pain, which, because of the law of karma, will only end up hurting us too. So the far enemy is cruelty, and the near enemies of compassion are pity and grief, falling into overwhelm or despair. And these are called the near enemies because at first glance they might seem like they're the quality we're aiming for, but they're just a bit off in some way. So for example, pity might from the outside seem like it's in the terrain of compassion, but if we investigate more closely, we might sense that energetically there's a kind of distancing or separation or even superiority to it. Oh, you poor thing over there suffering. I'm so glad that's not me. So if we do recognize this kind of disconnection, we might need to re-establish the foundation of metta, or kindness, or warmth. Get it happening a little more strongly before we again direct it towards compassion. Or it might be better to change the person that we're working with to someone who's less likely to evoke pity instead of true compassion. And changing our focus like this is not cheating. So with all of these Brahmavihara practices, we're encouraged to start where the quality comes most easily and then gradually expand our capacity to offer it to a wider range of beings. So a second challenge that often comes up when we're practicing compassion is that because we're coming into direct contact with pain and suffering, it can be easy to fall into sorrow or grief. But this is not true compassion. And sometimes there's a misunderstanding of compassion as being simply empathy. So sometimes it's presented as feeling the pain of another as if it were our own. But this can easily lead to what's known as compassion fatigue or empathy burnout. And in the Buddha's teachings, what prevents this burnout is that orientation to the wish for the pain to be relieved. So if we do find ourselves getting lost in the suffering, we might need to emphasize the relief or the release aspect of it, even if it's just imaginatively. So perhaps visualizing the person or ourselves being experiencing some moments of being free from pain. So depending on the circumstances, we might imagine the person recovering their health or getting out of debt or finding a better job or being involved in a healthier relationship, or whatever the situation is. There may be cases where it's not realistic, for example, if somebody has a terminal diagnosis, to imagine, and knowing that they're not going to recover, we might not visualize them fully recovering, but we can orient to those moments when they experience some relief from pain. Or perhaps when they have a loving connection with family members and so on. So this can be a very creative practice. So one of the challenges of any of the Brahmavihara practices, and perhaps especially compassion, and perhaps especially self-compassion, is that it can bring us into contact with some very deep conditioning, as I touched into last night. We start to recognize painful self-views, unworthiness, all kinds of different mind states, difficult mind states. So I'd like to offer a few suggestions now for working with any challenging emotions that might come up. And the first point, the most important point, is that we want to work with these very gently, very gradually. Because it's a common pattern in relation to strongly painful emotions for people to flip between two extremes. It's our binary nature again. So one extreme is just to reflexively avoid, ignore, deny, repress, not allow our awareness to go anywhere near what's painful. And the other is to push ourselves to drill down into our most deepest and most excruciating trauma and then stay there, which, because anything less than that is somehow cheating. But this is just another symptom of that same pattern of wounding, of hurt, that we're trying to heal. So keep in mind when we're working with difficult emotions that we're always trying to stay in balance in relation to them to some degree. So remembering the Buddha's emphasis on the middle way. In terms of difficult emotions, we can think of that as the balance between not avoiding, ignoring, repressing on the one hand, but not feeding, indulging, or getting overwhelmed on the other. So again, this means listening to ourselves, paying attention to the context that we're in, and being aware of our current capacity to meet those challenges. And then, when the timing feels right, we might choose to take a session of meditation to investigate those challenging states more directly and to start to explore what might be underneath those afflictive thoughts and emotions. So just a couple of cautions. We want to, if the reactions, the emotions that we're exploring are very intense, perhaps even in the realm of trauma, we want to be touching into them in very small doses. So I often joke about homeopathic doses. So it's just enough to strengthen our emotional immune system without overwhelming it. And often when we do touch into some kind of painful emotion, what's the first response in the body? Yes, thank you. That tightening, contracting, tensing up, shrinking, resisting, bracing against it, which makes the experience feel even more unpleasant, amplifies it. So as an antidote to that first bodily reaction of resistance, I like to use a mantra that I borrowed from the Zen teacher Charlotte Joko Beck, and that mantra is A, B, C. A, B, C stands for A, bigger container. So we're trying to make space for that difficulty. So we notice perhaps the clenching of the jaw or the shoulders hunching or the arms bracing, and we remember A, B, C and try to literally make space for whatever the emotion is. So we might sit up a little straighter, open up the chest, breathe a little deeper, maybe invite some softening in the eyes, the jaw, the shoulders, the chest and the belly. And if the contraction and the closing down persists, we might take in the space of the room to help remind us to make that bigger container. So we make a bigger container in the body. If that doesn't feel enough, we open to the bigger container of the whole room. So we might open our eyes, feel that space. And if even that doesn't feel enough, we can open beyond the room to the vastness of the sky. So we might just take a moment to look at the sky and to remember that sky-like awareness that can hold it all, know it all, without being affected. Or if you're a visual person, you might imagine surrounding that contraction in the body with golden light, or dissolving it with fine vibrations of warm energy. But just finding your own way to begin to release that contraction around it. So the analogy with making a bigger container, it's sometimes said that this is like if you have a wild horse and you put it in a small corral, it goes crazy and it kicks and bucks and the energy is very intense. But if you let that wild horse out into a bigger paddock, it's the same energy, but because it's in a bigger space, it doesn't have the same impact. So A, B, C is one strategy, and then touch and go is another strategy. So if we're at danger of getting lost in the emotions, we might need to practice just touching in to whatever the painful feeling is and then going. And going can mean metaphorically or literally moving elsewhere. So if we have enough capacity, we can just move the attention somewhere else. So for example, pay attention to neutral or pleasant feeling tone somewhere in the body or any of the senses. If we're drowning in the unpleasantness of the experience, then we open up. What else is true right now? Can I connect just to the softness of the shawl, the warmth of the clothing, the support of the sitting bones on the cushion, and so forth? So we go to what's pleasant. And again, this is not cheating if we're doing it with full awareness and in the service of maintaining balance. If we're not able to find anything pleasant in our immediate experience, we might go to a pleasant memory, maybe an iconic time when we really felt safe, whole, at ease, strong, and so forth. And we bring that memory back into our minds as vividly as we can. Or at times we might be able to go and just decide, okay, now is the time to take a cup of tea, or go for a longer walk, or sit under my favorite tree in the forest, or do whatever feels supportive, nourishing, soothing to help you come back to balance. So these are all ways of what we could call titrating the dose of our exposure to what's painful. And in the medical profession, titrating refers to getting the right dose of a medicine. So we want to have just enough that it strengthens our immune system, but not so much that we have side effects, and not so little that it doesn't have any effect. So one way of titrating, if we are doing this kind of exploration at home, is to use time limits around something. So if something, we have some deep-rooted, painful situation that we want to explore, we might literally set a timer for 30 seconds, and then we might just lie down, hand on the belly, hand on the heart, and feel in to what is happening in that painful situation, staying out of the story, out of the narrative, and just feeling into the body, the emotions, any associations or images that might be coming up with it, and do our best to stay steady with those. And then after 30 seconds, whew, okay, that is enough. And then we go and do something completely different that's nourishing, restoring, and so on. And then maybe a week later or a month later, we come back, we do 45 seconds. So we're just gradually extending our capacity to be with these more intense, painful states. Okay, so finally, self-compassion. Again, we want to approach this with care. It's never helpful to try to blast through our defenses or rip the heart open. And so the encouragement is to find your own way into the practice. You might at times just put a hand on your heart, like we did the other day, and to feel your own responsiveness and aliveness, and perhaps to steady any quivering that might be there. You can experiment with phrases. I'll be offering some soon, or you can find your own language that works for you. And then when the painful emotion does release, it's really important to notice that and to let that in, to acknowledge it, even to celebrate it. Because the more we can release these afflictive emotions, the more space there is in the heart and mind for the skillful qualities to grow. But again, because of our inherent negativity bias, we tend to be much more on the alert for what's problematic and painful. And we tend to be much more focused on what's wrong with our practice. And to not even notice those times when we are free of afflictive emotions. But as the practice matures, we want to pay attention to the absence of the hindrances, to recognize those times of ease and happiness and peace and freedom, even if it's just for a few seconds at a time, because this is an aspect of the wise effort that I talked about the other night, the effort to help skillful states to arise, and when they have arisen, to help them stay for longer and to deepen. So that's what we're going to be practicing very soon, a fairly short guided compassion meditation. And we'll be using the traditional method where we recite phrases that are intended to evoke the quality of compassion. And then we offer those phrases, in this case, to someone we're close to and we care about. Someone we care about but who's currently experiencing some kind of difficulty or challenge in their lives. So this could be a good friend, it could be a family member, a partner, anyone who you know quite well who's having a hard time of some kind. But because this is a gradual training, I encourage you not to choose someone who's going through the most extreme difficulty or crisis. So we can use a scale of 0 to 10. And if 10 is the most intense anguish and suffering, then please choose someone to work with whose difficulty is a 5 or less. And in the phrases, I'll be using the word pain, but that word is not just physical pain. So it includes emotional pain and any kind of difficulty or challenge.